topic, we've already started to talk about some of these issues anyway, so let's just keep the conversation flowing. But let's just talk about, as we've started to discuss, the scope of the model contracts. So what are the general provisions that should be addressed in the model contracts? You know, in MAP 21, where Congress has provided more of an indication that they anticipate that public-private partnerships will be among the considerations for states delivering transportation projects going into the future. A common thread throughout all of the areas where they've addressed public-private partnerships is the concept of the value proposition and the goal of protecting the public interest. So in the model contracts, should we be certain to provide provisions that address the protection of the public interest? I think I heard somebody address competing facilities. You know, the non-compete clauses were a major issue in the early days of public-private partnerships in this country, as evidenced by what happened with SR 21. So do we, I mean 31, 91. So as we move into developing the set of provisions that will be addressed in the model contracts, should we be looking at focusing on including something related to competing facilities? Somebody talked about addressing the federal requirements. We may be particularly well positioned to do that. What are your thoughts on the types of federal requirements? I mean, we should run the gamut. Should we limit it? I mean, what are your thoughts on there? Are there things that we should be certain to exclude from the model contracts? That's probably something we really need to hear from you. So I think someone in this area had their hand up. I don't know if you're ready to comment on this topic or not. DJ, are you ready? Okay.
Poor DJ. We know him too well. He's a former DOTer.
Yeah, and actually I'd never introduced a DJ Gribben with McQuarrie.
We know who you are.
Yeah, thank you very much. The public protection... take this as more of a personal comment than a McQuarrie comment. These are state assets, and you got this. Let's assume we're doing a state, not a municipality. They're negotiating these things, so I'm not sure you would want federal guidelines under public protection limiting what a state could or could not do with its own asset. If you think about non-compete clauses, SR-91 was a very difficult transaction. It was kind of first of its kind, and so there were very aggressive non-compete provisions in there. Orange County ended up having to sort of repurchase the asset. Very happy ending, but really awkward transition to that ending. I don't know if, so you don't see non-compete clauses like that anymore. What you do have is you have compensation events. And the compensation events are important because obviously when you strike a deal as a P3, the government is agreeing that the private sector will have rights to do certain things, but then the government in its sovereign state allows itself the ability to change those rights, but thereby compensate the private partner if it does so. So if you were to come up with, I'm not sure how you would draft a public protection non-compete without potentially severely limiting what a state could do with its own asset.
Maybe a menu of options or any thoughts on that?
I'm not sure what that non-compete element would look like. I mean, I think the one thing we learned from SR-91 is that the government should never give away its ability to change something in the future, right? Mm-hmm. So we've seen that from then, that governments don't do that anymore. But if they retain the right to make changes in the future, then they should also sort of have the responsibility of compensating their private partner for any impact that change has on the deal that was struck originally as part of the P3. I don't know, Andrew, if you have any comments?
That's one thing to provide the model provision, but if you produced two pages amongst your package explaining what this sort of concept is, the reason why it's there, and issues to consider when actually negotiating that. Over the next 5 years, you'll probably, across the procurement, save about 1,000 hours of man time, because it's one of the key issues that's typically discussed in the first meeting, because as any advisor sat in this room who advises public authorities will tell you, that they themselves go through and explain to their client the reasons why this sort of concept should be included in the project. And invariably, their clients respond, well, let's hear it from the market, right? So if it's actually heard from you guys and is producing a document, it will have, back to a point earlier, it will have more credibility because, you know, it's disseminated from best practice, not just across the US, but across the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah.
If I could key in on two things that I heard, plus what Deborah said, you know, in the first block of conversation, the group settled on an educational approach, I would say. And I think I heard more of that educational approach from you, and Deborah's question certainly went to that. Could we do a menu? Would that be useful? But I heard from DJ that maybe even putting some of these things into a template, even an educational template, might be problematic.
Yeah, so let me clarify. For example, if USDOT was to come out with a provision that said you should not have a non-compete clause, I think that would be problematic. I mean, I totally agree with Andrew that what would be extremely helpful, but sometimes governments don't, I'm tempted to use an example. There was an example of a procurement where the government was going to concession certain items and then wanted the right at random to come in and take the use of those items for other governmental purposes, but didn't understand the need to compensate the private party for that partial taking. So I think what Andrew was getting at is if you, as USDOT, could come in and sort of help explain the general principles behind a P3, which is we're going to allow you the right to use this asset in exchange for payments, and we're going to allow ourselves the right to come in and change that deal, but we will compensate when you do that. I think that would be very helpful. If you were trying to sort of strike the balance, which has been somewhat controversial, around what is an appropriate non-compete clause, what is appropriate compensation clause, that could be very difficult and unwieldy. But explain educationally the general principles of why in the past you had non-compete clauses and why compensation clauses now make sense would be very helpful.
Neil Sweeney with Kilpatrick Townsend. I think these initial comments underscore the discussion about the format, that really what needs to be addressed is contracting principles to focus on all the players on the issues at hand, because it's not just true with respect to a non-compete. You can have the same discussion about right-of-ways, about utilities, about virtually every issue. And I think and it's going to be impossible to come up with model clauses in the time frame available, because they're not going to be readily adaptable to every project. So what needs to be discussed is why you need to confront issues like right-of-way and sort of the pros and cons or the trade-off if you try to shift all of that responsibility to the concessionaire. And then maybe either over time develop actual model clauses or just cite examples of how it's dealt with differently. Because even if you decide you're going to have a model clause, well, you can't draft a model clause relating either to non-compete or right-of-way or utilities, or you can go through a laundry list of things that have to be in these agreements that are going to be one size fit all. Because as the gentleman from the Virginia DOT pointed out, they just did three projects and each one is very unique. And that's something you're going to have to face. So in my mind, for the product that you're seeking to achieve, first of all, to achieve it, and secondly, so it's valuable and will be acceptable, it really needs to be along the lines of these principles, suggesting the pros and cons, and by implication, the best practices for consideration.
Okay. And yes, sir. Mark. And right now we're kind of talking about the you know, the general provisions that should be included. So at some point, it'd be interesting to me to get from the group, what would be the most general, what would be the most important general category? Would it be federal provisions, for instance? And then maybe what would be the second most? Because I think, and a lot of people have mentioned this, we're not going to be able to do everything all at once by December. So what would be the most important areas for us to hit on that would be useful, and then we could build on over time?
Thank you. I'm Rob Duke from the Surety and Fidelity Association, and my comments kind of bridge the last block discussion and this discussion here in terms of, I mean, certainly, and I think we can agree that, you know, we can't have prescriptive, a sample full contract because there are enough differences. And certainly, maybe even you can't prescribe the language of individual provisions. But I do think it's possible to prescribe best practices, principles. And getting into this point, you know, what are those principles that should be prescribed? And in the area of public protections, you know, one of the areas is performance bonding and payment bonding to protect the public interest. I mean, certainly you're dealing with a public improvement, although privately developed. There's a strong public interest to make sure subcontractors and suppliers get paid. There's a strong interest that the public at the end of the day has an improvement that they can use and enjoy. And so, you know, one, I think, key public protection as a best practice could be or should be the performance bond and the payment bond of the construction part of the PPP.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. If I could just follow up on that for one moment, though, I just heard words like best practice and guiding principle. If you could comment on how that fits in with an educational document. I mean, there's a number of models. There's a model that we could do, this is how you should do it. And then there is a model that, well, you don't have to do it that way, but, you know, this is what we kind of think is the best way, best practice. And then there's the model that says, well, here's what other folks are doing and here's what it means. And maybe even a little bit of this was their experience. Could you comment on kind of what you would see as the best approach? And this goes back to what Tamar was saying earlier about this notion of federal highway kind of being different than a trade association and what we say having some extra weight to it. And talk about the kind of flexibility that leaves or doesn't leave with individual contracts.
Well, I mean, I think it depends, or I think it varies. So it's certainly conceivable that not a single approach, you know, so, you know, you don't provide education from soup to nuts on all the issues. You know, there may be certain issues where you simply provide education. There may be some issues you identify where, you know, you just simply identify a best practice, or you say this is what other states are doing. But I think that there may be some issues, and one is maybe public protections, and there may be others, maybe just a handful, where you're actually prescribing the best practice. So that we're not going to give you language, but that the contract needs to address this. It is so important that it should have this. So I'm not sure if you get to the point of saying that the overall approach is educational or the overall approach is prescriptive, but it may depend on the issue that you're dealing with.
Thank you. Any follow-up on that? Sir?
Hi there, Ryan Bolley with the Owner Operator Independent Drivers Association. I think from the user's perspective, you know, there's a lot of, from what he just said, and then a lot of what Nick said earlier in terms of not just the need to focus on public protections. I think from our perspective, we want to see the maximum amount of focus on those as possible because, you know, we've frankly seen a lot of bad situations in regards to those that have impacted our members and other motorists in a negative way. But also making sure that the political officials back at the state understand the trade-offs. And, you know, these are very complex documents and necessarily so, but, you know, you've got maybe a very short term of time from an elected official to understand what they mean. and understand, you know, get some plain language understanding of, you know, this is the trade-off between this and this, and this is what it means for your constituents when the contract includes this type of language, and this is what it means when the contract includes that type of language, you know, whether it's a non-compete or, you know, some of the other, you know, payments out there, you know, really understanding what that means to the user out there is I think just as important as making sure that we do maximize as many of those public protection provisions in some form of a base document as possible.
Okay, great, thank you. And again, as Regina mentioned, I mean, the public protections notion and the competing facilities ideas, I mean, they're just ideas to start your thinking, but what are some of the other general provisions that we need to be sure we include or address in the document?
And Deborah, we're talking about kind of general categories right now,
yes,
and then the next block we're going to get into specific provisions, correct?
Right.
That you're, the next section we're going to talk about specific issues, or are we listing them now?
That was the plan. I think we could combine the two, and that's okay too. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let me just respond to the second sub-bullet you have up there. I don't think this exercise should focus on identifying what the federal requirements are, because that is a situation and a dynamic that you have on virtually, you know, every public work, whether or not it's federally funded. And I think it's appropriate in the course of all procurements that a public sponsor is going to identify potential federal regulation, but in effect, you don't want to become the proposer's lawyer and telling them what federal requirements do or do not apply, because federal requirements that apply as a matter of law. So, I mean, this is an issue. It's an issue on, I just dealt with it recently on DOE-funded power projects and things like that, and it's a thorny issue, but it exists completely separate from P3. So I personally don't think that this effort needs to focus on that as something unique to P3.
Could you help me out just a little bit? I'm kind of not understanding why you wouldn't want to include federal requirements in a P3 template.
From an educational standpoint, what I would say is to the public sponsors to make certain that proposers understand potential federal requirements and how that might impact the entire project, ultimately from a dollar value. Because especially when you have overseas companies coming in, they don't necessarily appreciate the impact of Davis-Bacon and other compliance issues in federal procurement. So it's important to emphasize to them, and to the extent you're aware of them, to identify them. But the bottom line, that is going to be the responsibility of the concessionaires or the contractors out there. And again, my point is that's not a unique circumstance to P3. If there's certain regulations that either by the regulations the public sponsor has to identify, go ahead and do that. But, you know, that's an enormous exercise, and I think the focus of this program should be on issues that are unique to P3.
Okay, so I'm glad I asked. That's a good point that you made for our consideration, is drawing a box around this exercise that we're just talking about P3s and we're not talking about project requirements. Okay, sir.
I think, obviously, my very first comment suggested that we should have specific language to deal with federal requirements. Just to be clear, I'm not looking on behalf of foreign individuals for an explanation of what Davis-Bacon actually means. It's more the sort of provisions that I'm focused on is that personally I don't really think, and this is a real life experience, I don't personally think it's appropriate in the context of a 2 to 3 year procurement for within the last month of that procurement for the procuring authority to find out from federal government that they don't like the change in ownership provisions in a concession agreement, right? I think that's far too late in the process. That requirement is not prescribed in federal legislation. It is a requirement that has evolved over time. And that is one of many issues of a federal nature that negatively, my personal view, negatively impacts some of these procurements. And it's those issues that I think it's time to flush out and put to bed and document so that everybody understands and knows what issues they're going to face. And that exercise alone should not be a difficult exercise to conclude, because the know-how sits within a short space, a short distance of this room, and it should be written down somewhere. Everybody looks and wants to find out where it's set down, but maybe finally we have the opportunity to actually document that.
Okay.
So that's what I'm focusing on.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, good
Mark,
point.
You have someone?
You're next. Do you have a microphone? Okay. There you go.
Steve Howard, Barclays. I just want to circle back on two earlier comments. First is the non-compete versus compensation issue. I don't think that this exercise should take a position on either of those topics. I think they both should be identified, and there should be commentary about them, but I don't think there should be a position taken that non-compete is out of date and has been replaced by compensation event provisions, because there still could be situations where the local decision makers, for whatever reason, decide that a non-compete makes more sense. Secondly, some other individual touched on another whole broad topic area, and I think we passed over it a bit too quickly, and that's the whole area of compensation, either in the form of availability payments or a revenue-based deal. I think that's a whole very broad area that has to be discussed and put in context. And all of the sub-provisions under a revenue-style contract with revenue sharing, the sharing of the benefits of refinancings, and various benchmarks for how revenue sharing might change depending upon how the asset performs. That's, I think, a very important area that a lot of education could be helpful. Then on the availability payment side, the whole issue of the source of the payment for availability payments and how the concept of appropriation, which is not familiar to many participants in the market, offshore participants in particular, how that fits into the picture and what the different mechanisms are. Again, not prescriptive, but commentary, and how that could potentially affect how a contract is drafted.
Thank you. Morteza?
I'm just talking from the experience that we went through recently about Route 460 project and the other two projects also in Virginia. As Andy mentioned, I believe we should have FHWA in the game earlier during procurement, because we go to proprietary meetings, we sit with the private companies, we negotiate many different provisions with them, we put a contract together, we send it to FHWA division for their review, and that's the time that we figure out that there are some of the provisions that either they ask us to remove entirely or change entirely, or they make some recommendations that it is not in the interest of state or public to have this provision, so maybe it should be changed. And that's too late, because it makes it difficult for them, and it makes it difficult for us and everybody at that point of time to address those comments. I will also suggest that maybe FHWA division can be very helpful, because they have gone through this process with us. They know a lot of different provisions that we have used. They have provided very useful comments, and maybe they can also be brought to the game, because in the state level, they have been involved on a daily basis with us. But there are a couple of things that maybe they are similar in all different types of projects. Back to my comment earlier that there are some provisions at program level that are similar. No matter what type of project you have, those provisions are there. For example, I mentioned earlier about DBE provisions. We just copied the same provisions from 95 and used it for 460, just because we had gone through that exercise before with FHWA division. Everybody was confident with that, so we just copied and pasted, we use it. There are some provisions that they asked us in the last minute to make some changes that was related to the performance security, and it was mainly related to retainage on the DB contractor. So those things are maybe things that it's better to have standard provisions from FHWA. Everybody is comfortable with everybody. Everybody knows how they work. So when we go through that process, at least we know that what are the minimum requirements that has to be in the contract. And after that, we can go to that area, which is gray. So that black and white, and there are multiple things that I can think of, and I can, you know, add maybe later that because we went through this process, we have all the comments that we received from FHWA division. I'm sure that they also have it. We can provide that to you, and we can start just creating that list of all the requirements that division had when they were reviewing our contract.
Great, thank you.
Very good comments, and let me just say that we are working with the divisions to kind of bring some consistency and bring folks up the curve, and that's very much what, as an example, what Patrick is doing with that manual on Fed aid requirements, which goes back to a situation that we had with a Virginia project, and there was some confusion on that point, and so we said, okay, need to do a better job here, and that's what we're doing. So good comments, and certainly they inform this conversation, but they also inform what we're trying to do elsewise too.
There's a gentleman in the back. Jake?
Chad Ron Edwards at Chadbourne Park. I guess a question back for you that kind of goes on this same point is kind of what is the scope of your ability with what we're working on here. Would we be able to, with these types of provisions that we know are acceptable, kind of take a play from what we've seen other agencies like Treasury do and kind of say, look, if you've got, you know, a particular setup and it may be dictated in concept or in specific language, you know, there's kind of your safe harbor, and then you know later on down the road, you know, that's already acceptable. Now, if you need to do something differently, then you'll still look at it, but is declaring something like that kind of within your mandate here?
Well, again, I think that Congress has very much left that door wide open, and that's what we're trying to figure out is the best approach. And I think all of us have in the back of our mind, all of us that will be working on this, have in the back of our mind as we're listening to you all talk that what we probably want to do is to hone in on the model that we think will be most useful, and then start building it. And we won't have it all built out by the end of December, but it'll be something that goes on where we'll have some piece that's useful initially, and then we'll build on top of that. That would be my guess for how we will approach this. I doubt that, especially hearing all this conversation, I doubt that we'll be able to do everything, the complete job, by the end of December. But we should have a path forward and an early deliverable that will be of use. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, even in that situation where you may have kind of gone and given some guidance, of course, you know, we know all the states' legislations are different. You know, some already have things in place, and if there's two different things, you certainly aren't going to be able to put them both out there, and some of them you won't be able to state. But if there's provisions that you're specifically looking at, especially if it's a deal that is supported by a program like TIFIA, and there's provisions that you're looking at in the underlying PPP agreement, you know, kind of giving some guidance on those early on so that people know to start with, you know, XYZ is already acceptable, and let's start with that, then not, you know, later on down the road that it should be good to go. That would be something, and those would be the types of provisions here that maybe could be a little bit more fleshed out or take the priority.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I appreciate hearing that comment, and that gives us two things to think about. One, should we have TIFIA sorts of considerations rolled into what we're doing here, or maybe not. Maybe we should do something under the umbrella of TIFIA that is a little bit more prescriptive. I think somebody said early on, you know, they were concerned that this effort might influence what was going on with a TIFIA project. So that's something that I think we need to consider. And once again, I feel like we're ignoring this side of the room. Any comments? Yes, sir. Mark.
Greg Durkers with the National Governors Association. And I just want to thank you all for convening this. It's been very interesting. And in our work with states and with governors on really P3 education, I think this overall scope that we're talking about at the contract would be very useful. I would maybe encourage that if we are going to exclude things, and there's been some discussion back and forth on, you know, how broad to go, to including federal requirements, other sort of non-compete questions. If there is things that are excluded, it might be useful to list that and say we've excluded X, Y, and Z, and here's why. Because I think governors, you know, and their advisors will probably look to this this information as a first tier resource.
Thank you. Anyone else from over here? I can't pick on Leon anymore. I've already done it enough. He'll never come back. Okay. Yes.
Okay, QC.
It's QC from University of Maryland. And just back to your question here, is that is there any things that we should not should be excluded? I would say basically, you know, like, you know, the group has a consensus that might become an educational tool. And everything, every provision that have been used in any projects that have the merits there, that basically probably just, you know, consider all kind of risk mitigation strategy for that specific project. So my suggestion here is that since we have many project P3 projects already done or undergoing here, so those provisions represent some special scenario for individual projects here, and that should be documented as a alternative within this model. So I see this model, you know, consider the flexibility there. It's more like, you know, we call it a contract engineering, that you have everything's layout there, provision. It could be general, could be specific, a specific provision, but it's just the alternative. That's a toolkit that we have. And individual states, all, you know, sponsors, they have their specific project, and they lay out their risk, their responsibility they want to do. And those are toolkits that FHWA or IPD office have this toolkit provided. Those individual specifications basically describe the risk allocations between those two party or three party among those. And let them to really see that this is a tool that available, special provision, educates them. And then they can pick up anything there. So I see that, you know, this the format and also this effort can lead to a big success when, you know, they use this as a special toolkit and educate them and use that in the future. So it's more like, because I'm from engineering side, so I prefer something like engineering side. It's more like, you know, they can build their contracts, just like, you know, design an engineering bridge that you plop these individual provisions to fit your need, something like that. So
you're really talking about more of a cafeteria, style approach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have on our website P3 legislation, and it's kind of sliced and diced by this state did this and this other state did that. And we don't really comment on whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but we have what others have done out there so that when someone new is coming along, they can go back and use that as a reference and get some good ideas. Mm-hmm. Is that something of what you're... But I'm hearing maybe you want a little bit more.
You could have that general categories that define... You know, this is a responsibility, and also this is a risk that you should consider. let's say, renegotiation, whether you should include that in the contract or not, what scenario you should. But go back to the individual project. You know, their individual project is unique, so you cannot really consider all the scenarios there. So, you know, basically is that we call it incomplete contract. Whenever you, design a model here, it's always incomplete. You cannot consider all the scenarios there. So you got to be flexible on this. And provide all the tools available. Most of the time, I believe to protect the public interest in a better way is that to let the state, let everybody in the games to know what are those toolkits available. And just give you an example that when we did a case study on New Mexico 44 project, that you all know that the last time that they have the design built and the operation maintenance, there's no financing mechanism within that. But the thing here is that when the private company bid on this project, do this, and they design this contract in a way that public has not been aware of, so that their responsibility, their risk, the public believe that the risk has been transferred to the private sector, but because of the negotiation, the contract, individual contract, totally changes the risk allocation. And so even you have the value for money analysis at the beginning, you know that you want to really design or allocate the risk in this certain way, but individual contract provision really totally changes the risk allocation. So that is beyond the value for money analysis. So the point here is that the model contract provides this a list of, I forgot the people talking about that, education tool, list all the alternatives that are available, special provisions, and then provide what is the pros and cons for that, and then, state can use that. That's my thought.
Okay, thank you.
We have a gentleman over here.
Alex Jett from the World Bank. One thing that we run into at the World Bank, which is roughly analogous to having different states with different amounts of experience conducting these projects, you have some countries that have never done P3s at all. You have your Brazils or your Mexicos that have done many. So we've made toolkits that try to be as general as possible. But every once in a while, somebody will want to push a provision. They'll want to push like the UK model for contracts or the French concession design. And because you have these legal frameworks within each country, you cannot, to kind of follow up on what he said, you cannot push this one size fits all. But one comment I was thinking about making earlier, and I guess I'll make it now, one thing we are trying to do is kind of have some common language so that between countries, when they're talking about defining concessionaire, grantor, whatever it is, you can talk to each other in some common terms. So it's a very general comment, but that may be useful across states so they can truly compare best practices and compare apples to apples. That's all.
That's a very good point. Thank you.
So we should look to develop a list of definitions, maybe, as an attachment to whatever form this takes.
Almost a glossary, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gentleman back here.
It's John Small with Nossaman. Just to follow up on that, I was toying with that, and quite frankly, I thought that's where you were going earlier today, that we all talk about a concessionaire. We know what a concessionaire is. But I'd be remiss not to beat on the drum that's been coming before, which a definition is just like a contract provision. And so if we start telling everyone what a concessionaire is, and we define them as you would suggest, then we are, in a way, prescribing what it isn't, or certainly the contours of what it is. And I was, in my own mind, toying with the necessity for this so that we all speak about things generally the same. Gentleman from FDOT, availability payments. I'm presuming that everyone in this room knows what an availability payment is, but Governor X may not have a real strong sense of what an availability payment is. There's got to be a way to educate, here's what an availability payment is, without saying, here's what an availability payment is. And that's if everybody's following me. That's that's the idea in my head. So I just wanted to dovetail on what I think is a really great idea of having a taxonomy of terms that pervades P3, so we all start, you know, orbiting the same place, but we're not landing on the same landing platform. Thank you.
So how would you go about doing that? How would you...
That's fair. And at the risk of putting my firm out there as telling you how to do that, I have a lot of bled ink on the education strategy being here's an availability payment at an instant in time at a particular place with a whole lot of, we're not going to go into the weeds about why these risk allocations were the way they were, but here's an example. Here's another one. Here's how they do it in the UK. Here's how they do it in the UK. You describe them in the context of what they were doing and then let the user of this document or these things that you give them extract what they want from that. But the ancillary benefit is they are educated simultaneously that there's a thousand ways that these things happen, but they're also starting to use the word availability payment, and then they come into conversations with an or at least a starting point of an of a vicinity of an understanding of what we're talking about, which to the gentleman from BAH saves thousands of hours of education time, at least on the part of council and others. So I don't hope you didn't take that as an elusive answer, but I'm not going to come so far as to say availability payments are this because by necessity excludes other things.
Well, what I was going to say is for most of these things, you could probably come up with a pretty broad definition and then say that there are variations on the theme.
I would agree with that, although I would want the variations on the theme to be the exception that swallows the rule in the description.
Fair enough.
Just to support that, I mean, I think that on the advisory side, we're seeing that that's what a lot of the agencies are asking for is just comparison charts and precedent charts. And that is how often, that's how they often arrive at some of the decisions that they make. So to the extent that this exercise can facilitate that by serving as a, you know, another more consolidated data point, I think that would be very helpful to the agencies. I mean, I think that you had asked earlier, you know, what is best practice? And I think that definition would be very hard to come by because best practice for the purposes of risk allocation would look very different in a term than best practice for greatest cost savings. So I think, yeah, I mean, and you have to kind of let the public owner understand what the trade-offs are between one one goal and the other. So I think that to the extent that this, you know, very large undertaking could serve as a way to help consolidate information in the industry, it would be very helpful.
And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking that it's a challenge for us to kind of figure out what to put in the various pots that we've got going on. So we have these model P3 contracts that we need to develop. We also have case studies that Congress has mandated that we develop and that we put out there for others to use. We've got a P3 toolkit that Patrick is working on that will have a lot of educational material in it. We're going to do a lot of outreach pertaining to that toolkit. So I think the challenge is going to be is to make sure that these model contracts don't get too big and that we don't try to do too much in them. I'm just thinking, for instance, using that example, availability payments, we probably, I'm guessing, you know, just my off-the-top thinking, we probably don't want to talk too much about availability payments per se unless we have an actual model contract for availability payments. And we can take care of that educational piece through one of the other activities that we have going on. Just a thought. And that's why this conversation is so important, to help us really drill down and figure out what should be in these model contracts.
And to that regard, what's in the model contract? We start off talking about, you mentioned, do we want something that's prescriptive? Do we want something that's just generally informational? I think the group was generally informational with a couple exceptions that I picked up, and that was Andy mentioning, when you talk about DBE or change of control. So, I mean, one way you might want to think about it is that different provisions will have different amounts of prescriptive direction that people will look for from federal highways. So if you think about, you know, non-competes and how those are structured, that's probably a big picture policy issue the states to decide and give them some things to think about. Like, as you're thinking about how you structure this, these are just general policy decisions. But then all the way down the spectrum, we talk about sort of change of control provisions in a TIFIA agreement. I think at that point, the industry would like to know with some degree of specificity what it is that Federal Highways would like to see. So the question is, would we like that in a model contract? I'll play your role, Regina. I think yes. I mean, on ones that are TIFIA loans, we would love to see ahead of time, and I think you heard this from both Alan Overy and then the Commonwealth of Virginia, we would love to see ahead of time what it is Federal Highways wants, so we don't run into the circumstance, which can happen and has happened, where you're almost on the verge of close and there's still a conversation going on about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate.
Yeah, there's the legal requirements that are frankly non-negotiable, almost. DBE is an example, you know, Buy America is another example. And frankly, that's kind of low-hanging fruit for this exercise if we decide that we want to put it into the contract, because it is what it is. There's no variations on that. But what I'm hearing you say is that you'd like to see a little bit more about maybe things that are more variable and that TIFIA would be comfortable with accepting, which, and I'm just wondering, is that maybe a project for TIFIA to do as opposed to taking care of that under the model P3 agreements?
It could either way, but we actually had a DBE issue and a change of control issue that ran all the way to the very end. So the Commonwealth of Virginia wanted to do DBE a certain way. They thought that would actually be more efficacious than the way they'd done it before, and there was that kind of disagreement. So maybe going back to the Treasury safe harbor idea, where you would spell out, if you do A, B, C, you're good. It doesn't mean you can't do D and E, right? Or you can't change A, B, C, and we're open to variations A, B, C, but if you do it this way, then we're done, we're finished, we don't need to talk about that anymore, would be very helpful.
Thank you. Mark has someone ready to comment.
Thank you very much. Seth Miller, Gabriel Jacobs. I would have to agree with a lot of the comments about having terms and definitions and some. The point I'm getting at, an awful lot of states and MPOs and cities and counties come to public-private partnerships who like to think out of all the best intentions, but most of the time it's out of desperation, that they have no way of funding or financing a project, and they really want to know how they get money from the federal government. And maybe if you could set the terms and definitions that come from this as an idea of, well, this is what has worked to get you a TIFIA loan in the past or some sort of funding. That's really what they want to know so that they can get this project done. So if you're going to put in any kind of model contract or definitions, because this is what USDOT or FHWA believes availability payments mean that have been approved for TIFIA financing in the past. And that's really what, if I'm the head of an MPO, I want to know. Other than that, I probably don't care because I just want to get the money, unfortunately. And that's what they're looking for.
Okay. Thank you. Jake, you had something. And we're going to take this comment, and then shortly after this comment, I hate to break the momentum because everything is going so well here, but we are endeavoring to produce a transcript and an audio recording. So we're going to need to switch out the tape. So we're going to take an unscheduled 10-minute break right after this commenter, and then we'll resume. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, Brad Shipp again from Parsons Springer Hoff. I wanted to hit on something that I've heard a number of people say, and that's best practices. And I struggle a little bit with that because in a lot of ways, there aren't necessarily a best practice for any given kind of contractual term. There are options and a range of options. And to say that, you know, to define like, well, this is best practice or this is state of the practice, you're almost pushing people towards, you know, this is what you should be doing, when it really depends on a number of factors. And what's important is that the sponsors of projects understand what the range of options are and understand where those options work best and are able to make an informed decision. So I think we need to draw the line at making a decision for a project sponsor and instead give them options and information.
Okay, a good place to take a break.